and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the inhumane conditions children are being held in at a Border Patrol detention facility in Clint, Texas, and speak with Nicole Austin Hillary, the U.S. Program Executive Director of Human Rights Watch, who is the co-author of a new report at CNN, "We Went to a Border Center for Children, What We Saw Was Awful." She joins us to discuss the unhealthy and unsanitary conditions these unaccompanied minors are being held in, and the appalling diet of cheap fast food that everyone from toddlers to young nursing mothers are being fed, and the cold cement floors the kids have to sleep on. As a result of the revelations by Nicole and other lawyers who exposed the cruel and callous conditions the children were enduring, the Trump administration ordered the children evacuated to an undisclosed facility, only to have them return later today to the Clint Detention Center. We'll assess whether President Trump is really interested in solving a problem that he uses as a rallying cry to whip up his base with poor, destitute kids from Central America held hostage to a Republican re-election strategy to paint Democrats as only caring about brown and black people as they give preference to non-Americans at the expense of red-blooded white Americans. And with the House poised to pass a $4.5 billion aid package to address the crisis on the border, we'll examine whether the pause in the mass deportation Trump promised to allow the Congress to pass this aid package will be met by a veto if the president doesn't get money for ICE and his wall instead of money to feed and shelter these kids in humane conditions, even though they are being unlawfully detained in the first place. Then we'll get an analysis of Trump's erratic foreign policy and the fix the master of the art of the deal has got himself into in the Middle East, with the Iranians holding the cards as Trump careens between offering peace and prosperity to hurling insults at Iranian leaders while threatening to obliterate their country. Shibli Talhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, who served as an advisor to the U.S. mission at the UN on the Iraq Study Group and as a senior advisor to the U.S. Department of State, and is the author of the forthcoming book, U.S. Foreign Policy in the Middle East Under Obama and Trump, joins us. Then finally, we'll speak with Jason Wilson, a reporter for The Guardian based in Portland, Oregon, who has an article at The Guardian, "Oregon Senator Walkout, Patriot Groups Vow to Protect Republicans Who Fled." He joins us to examine the undemocratic quorum busting going on in the deep blue state of Oregon, where the Democrats have a supermajority in the State House and the Senate, but the Democratic governor is poised to give up on a climate bill because of the tactics of the Republican senators who are hiding out in Idaho with burner phones, denying a quorum, out of reach of the Oregon State Police, who had to shut down the government over the weekend because of threats from militia groups who support the Republicans. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Nicole Austin Hillary, who is the U.S. Program Executive Director at Human Rights Watch, where her work focuses on improving the U.S. immigration system, tackling race discrimination, rights problems with the domestic criminal justice system, and advocating for national security policies informed by international human rights standards. Previously, she was the first director and counsel of the Brennan Center's Washington, D.C. office, where she served as the center's chief representative before Congress and the executive branch, and she's the co-author of a new report at CNN, "We Went to a Border Detention Center for Children, What We Saw Was Awful." Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicole Austin Hillary.
Thank you, Ian.
So I obviously want to talk to you about this dreadful, inhumane conditions of these children who are being held in Clint, Texas, on the border at a Border Patrol facility. They were actually moved out, and now we're learning that they've been moved back in. So, but before I get to that, let's just to put it in the context of the Flores Agreement. The Trump administration has not been forthcoming with the press and the Congress about what's going on in these facilities. They've been actually called concentration camps and generating some controversy. But it's only because of the Flores settlement, or the Flores agreement, that you and other lawyers were able to go in there. Is that correct?
That's correct. As part of that agreement, Ian, we were able to do what is called monitoring, which is often a part of settlement agreements that are part of larger pieces of litigation. And so that monitoring allows us to go into these facilities and actually do interviews with the detained children. And that is how we gained access to them, how we were able to talk to them about the conditions under which they were living and about the other experiences that they've had since they've gone into detention.
But under the Flores Agreement, children can only be held for 72 hours. So the Trump administration is already grossly in violation of the agreement, are they not? My understanding is that they want to break this agreement.
You are absolutely right, Ian. Children are only supposed to be held up to 72 hours. And we, in fact, talked to some children who had been there for 20 days plus. So it is unconscionable that those children have been living under those conditions for this amount of time. Now, as you say, the Trump administration wants to change this agreement, but good luck. This is part of a longstanding piece of litigation. It's something that the courts felt needed to be put in place, and those kinds of parameters are in place for a reason, to protect the most vulnerable, which are in this case children, and to ensure that they are not detained any longer than they need to simply get through the system, be identified, and for decisions to be made about where they should go for additional care.
But since the Trump administration is violating the agreement and holding kids for weeks, months, we simply don't know. These kids are being yo-yoed. Once the reports that you and your colleagues brought to the public's attention about these appalling conditions, the kids were moved out. Now we're hearing that they've been moved back in. Nothing has changed at the facility, has it, in terms of the diet, in terms of the fact that they have to sleep on cement, and that there's a lot of coughing and colds, etc., no toothbrushes, no soap, no washing, no bathing. I mean, it's just extraordinary. So describe what you saw.
Ian, I saw each day I was there crying children. That was consistent throughout. Every child that I spoke with was simply frightened. They were in the same clothes they had been in when they crossed the border. When we asked them when was the last time they bathed or how often they've been able to bathe, some, depending on how long they had been there, said they hadn't bathed at all, or they said, I've been able to bathe on one occasion. And even on that one occasion, Ian, when we asked, well, how long were you able to bathe, we were told, we're given only 3 minutes during which time we can bathe. It's almost like prison, where you are timed to do the basics of simply taking care of your daily hygiene. We asked the children, how often are you able to brush your teeth? In the United States, we're taught, growing up, you brush your teeth after every meal, or at minimum, you brush your teeth in the morning when you get up, or you brush your teeth before you go to bed. These children explained to us that they hadn't, in most instances, been able to brush their teeth in days. We saw children who were sick, who were coughing, who were wheezing because they were having breathing problems. And we asked, have they been given medicine? Or can we at least get them cough syrup? And then when we asked to speak to other children who were dealing with illness on a more consistent basis, we were told that those children were being detained in an area that they called the sick ward or the sick area, and that for our own safety, they were not going to give us access to them. And clearly, Ian, we wanted to see those children, because if we were viewing children who were already coughing and wheezing and clearly needed some kind of medical care, we desperately wanted to see what the children were looking like, who were quarantined in this other area, whom we were not given any access to.
Well, I think a lot of people saw this extraordinary footage from the Ninth Circuit Court where a Justice Department lawyer, Sarah Fabian, was grilled by the judges about these very issues, about kids not getting toothbrushes and not getting soap. And I have never seen such sort of heartless gobbledygook I mean, she simply wasn't making any sense. So isn't this then a deliberate strategy? It started with Sessions. It seems to me that what's going on here is that the Trump administration are using these poor kids as pawns to be simply deliberately cruel to somehow deter people from coming up from Central America. Is that what's going on here at the macro level?
It would seem to be so, Ian. And I will tell you, we as lawyers, often what we are asked to do in our cases is to make an argument as to what the rationale could be for the bad action that we are fighting against. And I have to tell you, when we look at every possible argument that could be made on behalf of the government, we don't see a rationale that can fully explain or defend why these children are being treated in this way. So, therefore, we are left to theorize as to what else the reasons could be. And it does seem to be that there are deliberate, there's deliberate inaction, if you will, Ian, to ensure that these children are not getting the kind of basic daily hygiene and care that all children deserve. We're really at a loss to explain any other rationale behind these actions.
But the food they're getting, Kool-Aid, frozen burritos, oatmeal.
Ramen noodles,
right. Mm-hmm. I mean, my understanding is it might even be worse at these for-profit detention centers they have, because by logic, you know, you make money out of your government contract by shortchanging. If you own a private prison, you may bill the government for, you know, a three-course meal, but give the prisoners bologna sandwiches.
Well, you know, I think that is one way to explain how private prisons make their money, because for them the bottom line is about, you know, how much money, you know, how can we make? What is the profit margin for us? But, you know, I can't speak to those so much, Ian, because I have to be able to speak about the facilities where I was. And I will tell you, not only did all of the children explained to us that they were getting that same diet that you just articulated every day. There are nursing mothers in those facilities that we talk to, Ian, because they are under 18. So there are mothers there with their babies, and we asked what kind of nutrition is being provided to these nursing mothers, because obviously they need vegetables, they need an array of fruits, because they have to be able to produce milk that is healthy for these babies. And we were told that those nursing mothers are getting the same daily nutritional menu that is being given to the kids. They are getting the oatmeal, they are getting the ramen noodles, they are getting the burritos. And of course we asked, are the children getting any fruits and vegetables? And they're getting none. So obviously, none of the children are being fed well, according to what we in the United States would consider good nutrition, nor are the babies who are breastfeeding receiving, ostensibly healthy milk from their mothers, because their mothers aren't on a healthy diet as long as they're in these facilities.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicole Austin-Hillary, who is the U.S. Program Executive Director at Human Rights Watch, where her work focuses on improving the U.S. immigration system, tackling race discrimination, rights problems within the domestic criminal justice system, and advocating for national security policies informed by international human rights standards. Previously, she was the first director and counsel of the Brennan Center's Washington, D.C. office, where she served as the center's chief representative before Congress and the executive branch. And she's the co-author of a new report at CNN, "We Went to a Border Detention Center for Children. What We Saw Was Awful." So going beyond the framework, if you will, of this being a deliberate policy of cruelty in order to deter people coming up from, many are escaping for their lives from these drug-riven, crime-infested countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And of course, counterintuitively, the Trump administration has cut funds to these countries. You would think that you would want to solve the problem at its source and make life more livable for people in these countries, so that they wouldn't have to flee and head north. But that's, again, the only explanation I can come up with is that this is a deliberate policy. But there's also this overlay of politics. And I think President Trump sees the border issue as a winning issue for him. And he's trying to paint the Democrats as only caring about brown people and black people and not white people. And their priority is taking care undocumented Americans as opposed to you good red-blooded Americans who want to build the wall. So that's the narrative that I detect. Do you think that that is what's also a part of this? In other words, it's not an incentive to solve this problem. It's an incentive to make this problem fester and rally his base.
No, there doesn't seem to be an incentive to solve this problem, Ian, because it does seem that this president is trying to appeal to a segment of the American population who simply doesn't believe that other people have the right or deserve the opportunity to come to America to make a better life for their families, even though that's been the history of this country, even though many of the people who make up President Trump's base are people who themselves are descendants of immigrants and come from families who were given the opportunity to come to the United States and find jobs and get good educations and pass those benefits on to their families. It is ironic that he seems to be appealing to a segment of the population who thinks that that door should now be closed. And, you know, frankly, that is deplorable. You know, the history of this country, Ian, is one in which it was meant to be a place of opportunity and to create opportunity, not just for some, but for all who entered the doors and came upon its shores. And the activity, the policies that are now in place by this administration simply goes against that grain. And I will tell you, Ian, when we talked to, because in some instances we talked to families, there was at least one family that I spoke with on day two of my trip who was from Venezuela. You articulated earlier some of the countries where these children were coming from. We also had families coming from Venezuela who told us that because of the political machinations and chaos that exist right now in Venezuela, they had to flee for their lives because their family had been targeted, they were being threatened, and they fled for their lives. And I talked to a father and a mother and their teenage child who said, we are coming to the United States because we want our family to be safe, and we want to be able to live in a country where we will not be targeted because of our political leanings or our political beliefs. We want to be someplace where our kids can grow up free. That's what the history of this country is about. And everything, frankly, that this administration is doing with respect to how it's handling immigration goes against that history.
Well, the president himself, of course, is married to somebody who emigrated here, and he's against chain migration. But nevertheless, Melania's family were able to, basically based on her green card and citizenship, subsequent citizenship, they were able to become permanent residents too. So it's a little bit hypocritical, given how close to home immigration is in terms of our president. But what do you think's going on with this bill that's before the House today? The president said that he would hold off on these mass deportations, give the Congress time to come up with a funding bill. The House is dealing with a $4.5 billion aid package. The Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, is trying to keep referring to this as an appropriations bill, not an immigration bill, because it's basically money to feed these kids that you witnessed in such terrible conditions. She's having to wrangle her caucus on the left because she's basically saying, you know, if we, the Democrats, who now control the House, if we can't get our act together and pass this bill, it's going to be a massive gift to Trump. The Senate has a similar bill. Where do you think it stands? Because, first of all, do you think Nancy Pelosi is right that the Democrats simply have to pass this bill?
I think she's right that the Democrats have to pass this bill because, frankly, Ian, what we're seeing and what Congress is noting is that a majority of Americans want smart and humane solutions and not more harm to come to the individuals who are migrating to this country, simply put. And they expect that Congress will do something about this problem. But here's the concern. The Trump administration simply doesn't seem interested in providing this humanitarian assistance to these children and to these families, even though they are seeking asylum from harm in their countries. You know, the president threatened a veto of the funding bills because he wants to see other things in these bills. You know, the bills are about, again, providing assistance to children and families that are in need. He wants to tie it up because he thinks that maybe there ought to be more money in these bills for jails rather than for families. That is not appropriate. This bill should be focused on just what Speaker Pelosi says it's focused on, which is providing additional humanitarian relief and assistance to these families and to these children. The president should not try to involve other issues that frankly seem to be more focused on politicking around the 2020 election than about doing real good here in the country around the issues that people are focused on right now. And so, we don't think that the president needs to be given a blank check. We don't think he should be given money to spend on more enforcement, that really enforcement that's already had appropriation set aside for it in fiscal year 2019. We think this bill should focus just on providing that humanitarian assistance, and he should not confuse the issues, which is what it seems he's trying to do.
So if his politics are such that he wants to keep this border issue alive to rile up his base, and he doesn't want to solve the problem, will he veto it then? I mean, if the Democrats can hold their caucus together, vote this thing through today, and as of now, when we're speaking, they're still wrangling over it. If they can get it to him and reconcile with the Senate bill, they've only got a couple of days before they go into recess.
Exactly.
What do you think? Do you think he can be so bold and cruel and heartless to veto it?
I think this president has shown himself to be one who's not necessarily responsive to doing the right thing, but is responsive to pressure from outside forces whose opinions matter to him. And so I think it's going to depend on what he's hearing from his base, what he's hearing from the talking heads whose opinions he values. But as I said a few minutes ago, Ian, what we've seen from research and from polling is that the majority of Americans want smart and humane solutions and not more harm to come to these families that are migrating to the United States. So I think it's going to depend on what kind of pressure he gets. And frankly, I think this is a moment for the entire country to use the bully pulpit of the public voice to let him know and to send a clear message that this is not what America represents and that we as a country have to do better. And frankly, I can only hope that there are people even within his own base, even among the Republican Party, even among the talking heads that he listens to, who want to see us do better. I don't think anyone, frankly, is very proud of the way we look as a nation this week as we hear the stories of these children, as we hear the stories of them being fed poorly and not being able to bathe and not being able to brush their teeth. Those are not partisan issues. Those are humanitarian issues. And frankly, I think if he feels the need to respond and to show himself in a better light, I think that might be enough to get him to support this effort. But again, that all depends on what he's hearing from his base and how loud the public outcry is. And for goodness sake, I hope the public outcry becomes even louder, because none of us should be okay with this. None of us should stand for this kind of treatment of any human being.
Well, just in closing, perhaps Melania Trump can tell her husband to be best.
I'll leave that to you, Ian, to send that particular message.
Well,
my message to him is let's be humans and let's be Americans and stand for exactly what this country was founded upon, providing fair and equal opportunity to all.
Well, Nicole Austin Hillary, I thank you so much, and I thank you for bringing this hideous story to our attention. Very, very important that the public know about what's being done in their name.
You're welcome, Ian, and thank you so much for providing a platform in which these stories can be told.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicole Austin Hillary, who is the U.S. Program Executive Director of Human Rights Watch, where her work focuses on improving the U.S. immigration system, tackling race discrimination, rights problems within the domestic criminal justice system, and advocating for national security policies informed by international human rights standards. Previously, she was the first director and counsel of the Brennan Center's Washington, D.C. office, where she served as the center's chief representative before Congress and the executive branch. And she's the co-author of a new report at CNN, We Went to a Border Detention Center for Children, What We Saw Was Awful. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an analysis of Trump's erratic foreign policy and the fix the master of the art of the deal has got himself into in the Middle East.
I just wanna be.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Shibley Talhami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has served as an advisor to the U.S. mission to the UN and on the Iraq Study Group, and as a senior advisor to the U.S. Department of State. He's the author of The Stakes, America in the Middle East, The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and Reshaping of the Middle East, and his forthcoming book is U.S. Foreign Policy in the Middle East Under Obama and Trump, and The Evangelicals and the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shibley Talhami.
My pleasure.
So there's been some insults traded between President Rouhani of Iran and President Trump. It's an extraordinary situation. The man that's supposed to be the art of the deal maker, Donald Trump, seems to have very few options. It seems that the Iranians have got all the initiative now. And most analysts I've spoken to say you can all trace this back to Trump pulling out of the JCPOA, the P5+1. That was an arrangement that restrained Iran and its nuclear program, and now all bets are off. And haven't the Iranians called Trump's bluff? I mean, what's he going to do now, apart from this sort of hostile rhetoric?
Well, you know, you can argue that the Iranians obviously are calling the shots. I think they're also in a bind. I don't think they're in a good place. But certainly Trump has boxed himself in. He's put himself on a slippery slope toward war. He doesn't want war, so he says. But obviously, some of his advisors apparently do, and many of us who have been looking at this from the outset understood that once you go down this path, that is, withdraw out of the Iran nuclear deal, which the Iranians were not violating, then impose new sanctions that are not really justified by any violations of the treaty, including cutting off their lifeline, the oil exports, then they're going to do something along the way to register that they can make everybody else's life more uncomfortable. And at some point, the president is going to be forced to react. He can't just delay it. He can't just say, I don't want war. He came close, obviously, to attacking Iran after the shooting down of the drone. His rhetoric goes, so unstable because on the one hand, he says, I called off the attack on Iran because it wasn't proportionate. And then today he comes up with this line with, if you attack anything that is American, anything, not a major attack, not on American life, anything that is American, he threatened obliteration. And this is a man who just lost a few days ago, talked about proportionality. And so it's really extraordinary. I mean, if you think that if you're trying to dissuade a country from developing a nuclear deterrent, and then you go and you threaten them with obliteration, just registering the point that they do not have a deterrent, what a way to stop them from doing so.
Well, it does seem that Trump doesn't want a war, and I think he's in a re-election mode. He doesn't want the price of gas to be up, $10, $20 a barrel, whatever it would go up to if the Straits of Hormuz were closed, which seems to be the implied threat from Iran, that if we can't get our oil to market, we can shut you guys down and you won't get your oil to market. And that, of course, would have a devastating effect on the global economy. But at this point, it seems that he sort of, maybe what explains this vacillation or this indecision is that his three top advisors, Mike Pence, the vice president, Secretary of State Pompeo, and National Security Advisor John Bolton, are all hawks. They apparently all wanted him to retaliate against Iran for shooting down the drone. And that's when, at the last minute, he reversed himself, according to press reports, because of something he saw on Fox News with Tucker Carlson suggesting it was a bad idea. So we don't quite know what Trump's decision-making process is. But do you think
that's part of the problem. That's part of the problem. And I think, you know, what you stated is probably the best that understanding that we have about what's going on, at least with Iran, or having these hawks who are, who, you know, in the past said they wanted conflict with Iran. So this is not something particularly new. But what worries me and others, I think everybody else should be worried, is that the president himself, he might have the instinct of not going to war. But, you know, when nobody is echoing that voice, because you've already appointed all these people who are essentially hawks in state, in NSC, possibly in the Department of Defense, and then you're left with moments where you have to make a quick decision, such as when the drone was shut down, and there will be more episodes, I think, coming up like that. And so you're caught, you know, only with your instinct, and the instinct, and you have another instinct, which we hear from him all the time. We are the most powerful nation on earth. You've insulted me. We're not going to let you get away with it. And so he does have these contradictory instincts. And there is certainly this group that is reinforcing the hawkish instinct that he sometimes expresses. And no one apparently echoing the other instinct. And frankly, you know, when you have something like the shooting of the drone, and you have a narrative which says they shot it over international waters. Obviously, the Iranians dispute that, and apparently was reported today that Russia actually takes Iran's side on that narrative. They think that the drone was actually shot down over Iranian territories. But once you take that kind of position and say, well, they shot this drone over international waters, even the people in the Department of Defense are going to say we have to react. You are a superpower. They shoot a major asset of yours in international waters. If that's the position you're taking, how could you not react? So in moments like that, you're going to have even people who restrain, who don't want war, in the Department of Defense and the CIA and elsewhere in the government saying, well, we're a superpower. We have to do something. And that's my fear, is that you get trapped in this slippery slope. And I think the president may think he's very smart. He can appoint all these people around him, and then he can overrule them, and he can even diminish them, as we've seen in some of his statements, including against his chief of staff, where he dismisses them like they're boys that could be insulted and thrown out of a room. But in the end, he may not be clever enough to understand what he put himself into, this slippery slope that is getting more slippery by the day.
And I imagine the Pentagon weren't too happy when President Trump thanked the Iranians for not shooting down an American spy plane with 30 on board. That was pretty surreal. I don't know.
Yeah.
You don't usually thank your enemies for not shooting down planes when they shot down one of your planes. So let's just touch on the evangelicals, because there's a symbiosis here, clearly, between the Iranian religious zealots. After all, it is a theocracy, although there are reports that the supreme leader, Khamenei, is a multi-billionaire. That's one of the issues under these sanctions, and the president of Iran, Rouhani, said no, all he owns is like a prayer room or something in a modest house. But the money obviously also funds the IRGC, and they're certainly religious fanatics. But in terms of the triumvirate in our foreign policy that are the hawks pushing Trump into war, two out of three of them are evangelicals who believe in the rapture. That's Pence and Pompeo. So I find that very disconcerting. It's bad enough having rational geopolitical dealings, but when you introduce religion and religious zealotry into the mix with apocalyptic overtones, that to me is really scary.
Well, I think there, you know, with the religious part, there are two aspects. It, you know, as you have mentioned, I'm writing a book about the role of evangelicals. It's really about evangelicals, politics, and the Middle East and Israel specifically. You know, the rank and file evangelicals, they have their faith. They understand their faith, but they don't really have political interpretations. And So in a way, I don't think the rank-and-file evangelicals are pushing the president to a hardline position. I think what you have is political leaders who are rallying evangelicals, who take positions that are not necessarily religiously based. They're really political based because of alliances that they make. And you know, they're happy to support the president, I think, because he supported them on almost all the issues that they have asked for, particularly his policy with religious schools and tax cuts and the Supreme Court, the Education Department, all of the things that they really wanted. So I'm not sure they're the ones who are pushing him in that direction. And I think the leaders, including those who are, pretend to speak for them, sometimes take these wild interpretations in support of the president. But we haven't seen that they're really driving it. But I do worry, nonetheless, that the use of religious imagery, whatever its root cause, whether it's a genuine or instrumental, is dangerous. It is dangerous because it does, you know, involve mobilizing publics in a particular direction. And in the case of the Middle East now with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for example, I do worry a lot when Trump's people, whether they're his immediate advisors on the Middle East, people like David Friedman, who is the ambassador to Israel, who is a very deeply religious Jew who believes that Israel has the right to the West Bank and settlements, have been saying so very frequently, particularly with regard to issues like Jerusalem. And then you have other evangelical leaders who are supporting the president who employ the same imagery. I worry about that a lot, not so much because of the immediate consequences for American policy. I'm worried, certainly worried about that. But in terms of defining the conflict in the Middle East as a religious conflict, you can't win that, because even if Israel slash Jews, whatever that means, or America slash Christians, whatever that means, have an upper hand today, if you define this as a religious conflict, not as a nationalist conflict, you're in for a long period of time of confrontation between I put that in quotation mark, Christian narrative, quotation mark, Jewish narrative, versus quotation mark, Islamic narratives, Arab narratives, and there is no end in sight. You can't win that in the long term. You could win the battle, but you lose the war, and you plant the seeds of future war. And that's the problem right now in using that imagery in addressing particularly the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because if that is the basis of it, then you are saying to Arabs and Muslims, who, even if they think they're also Egyptian first, the Jordanian first, they're still Arab and mostly Muslim, or Arab or Christian, Muslim or Christian. And you're saying to them that, quote, the Jews have the right to these lands, not the Arabs and not the Muslims. And that's a problem. And that's a problem because it'll come back to haunt you sometime down the road. And I do worry about it a lot.
Well, you mentioned Trump's, actually, he's Trump's bankruptcy lawyer. That was his only qualifications to become America's ambassador to Israel. And he is, you know, obviously he's made it clear, not just with the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, but with these statements about Jerusalem being an Israeli or a Jewish city into eternity. That clashes with the Saudis, who seem to be pretty close to Trump. In fact, there's no doubt about Trump and Jared. We don't even know what kind of deals they're making for after they get out of the White House in terms of Saudi sovereign wealth investments in their real estate business. But there's a lot of dealings going on, clearly, in this. That was the first visit that Trump made as a president abroad, was to Saudi Arabia. So he's made that a priority. But I can't imagine for one minute King Salman or even Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, a part of their so-called legitimacy is that they are the custodians of the holy shrines at Mecca and Medina. But the third one is the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, and that's where the Prophet Muhammad was supposed to have ascended into heaven. So how can you reconcile that? You've got the Saudis committed to this legitimacy that, you know, it's pretty hard to believe that they have that kind of legitimacy, but they claim it. They're not going to accept, surely, a total annexation of Jerusalem, are they?
Well, you know, let's separate religion and political expediency. There's no question that politicians and rulers do what they have to do to survive, and they prioritize and they rationalize and they do what they need to do in any given moment. That's what's really happening now in the coalition that is taking place around Trump's initiative to deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So people do prioritize, and the immediate priorities may shift, and they may think that they can disregard public opinion in the short term, although obviously they have to pay lip service to it, as you've heard today in the opening of Jared Kushner's Bahrain work economic workshop. You know, speaker after speaker from the Arab world who attended, despite the fact Palestinians didn't want them to attend, saying we all feel Palestinians, the Palestinian issue is the main one to us. We all, you know, they all repeat that they want to see Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine. So people repeat that, at least in terms of lip service, although the public doesn't take it seriously. So people differentiate, and let's differentiate between what rulers do for expedient reasons and what the public wants. But I want to say on this religious issue, I understand that people have religious faith. That's important. Most people do, actually, around the world. And everybody's entitled to their narrative. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's a Jewish narrative, Christian narrative, Muslim narrative, Buddhist narrative. Whatever it is, people have the right to their faith. Everybody does. And I understand that when people have certain commitments and they have a particular understanding to what that commitment means, even politically, and they live their lives accordingly, I have no problem with that. What I have a problem with is when somebody wants to impose their narrative to determine political sovereignty in our time. That is wrong. It is absolutely wrong, and it's also very dangerous because of what I said earlier, that it plants the seed of religious and ethnic conflict, which is much difficult to address in the long term.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, the former Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, once said that the Saudis want the Americans to fight Iran to the last American. And Pompeo, who's clearly a hawk, it just has met with King Salman and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. And then he's now meeting with MBZ, the leader of the Emirates, who is pretty much MBS's mentor, we understand. I know he's apparently trying to get them to pony up more naval assets to escort tankers. But in general, what do you think those conversations are about? Because if we started out the conversation suggesting that in a way, the Iranians are the winners so far. They've sort of boxed the U.S. into a dead end. They're not going to bend. What kind of pressure do you think MBZ and MBS are putting on Pompeo?
Well, I'm not sure that even MBZ and the Saudis, MBS particularly, the Crown Prince, actually want to see full war now. I mean, certainly in the past they have wanted to see Obama get into war. Some of them do think that war in the end would help them. And certainly that we know that the Israelis even more have wanted to see a confrontation with Iran. Obviously, they've opposed the Iran nuclear deal, particularly the government of Benjamin Netanyahu has opposed that deal and has been a big advocate of withdrawing and certainly a backer of the president. So I think they are worried about the oil issue, meaning what would happen to the oil supply. They all have to worry about it. How do you deal particularly with an Iran, which is likely to have, if not indirectly, have some groups perhaps carry out operations to disrupt oil shipping. So that's one issue, obviously, they all have to discuss. It's one that's important to them. They obviously have contingency plans that have to be considered. And there is also the question of this conference in Bahrain, which obviously the administration had wanted all the Gulf states to participate in, and they are participating. In fact, it's actually being technically co-hosted by the government of Bahrain. So there are lots of issues to discuss, but I'm not sure whether Pompeo had a particular specific message beyond coordination as tension is rising with Iran. Obviously, the big issue facing everyone right now in the Gulf is the Iran issue. It's certainly not what Kushner is doing in Bahrain. That's something that is, they don't, you know, even people who participate really don't take it too seriously. They're kind of, they know they're appeasing the president on this. Some of them are there reluctantly, actually many of them are there reluctantly, but they don't see that as a priority issue for them at this point.
Well, Shibli Talhami, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Shibli Talhami, who's the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and the non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has served as an advisor to the U.S. mission to the UN and on the Iraq Study Group and as a senior advisor to the United States Department of State. He's the author of The Stakes, America in the Middle East, The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion, and The Reshaping of the Middle East. And his forthcoming book is U.S. Foreign Policy in the Middle East Under Obama and Trump, and The Evangelicals and the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the undemocratic quorum busting going on in the deep blue state of Oregon. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jason Wilson, who is a reporter for The Guardian based in Portland, Oregon, whose latest article at The Guardian is Oregon Senator Walkout, Patriot Group Vow to Protect Republicans Who Fled State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Wilson.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Well, thank you. And it's an extraordinary display of how democracy is not supposed to work going on at the state capitol in Salem, Oregon. The governor, Kate Brown, has more or less given up on the climate bill that the Democrats were trying to pass, more or less saying that the bill is dead, that Senate Republicans, quoting her, have blocked a bill that provides a better future for our state and for our children, and the tactics they have employed to do so are not just unacceptable, but dangerous. So let's talk about the dangerous tactics. What's going on there with the governor threatening to have the state police arrest these Republican senators who went AWOL to deny a quorum in the Senate? They're probably out of state. I think they're in neighboring Idaho. But some of them have called on militia groups to protect them from the state police. And my understanding is that the state house was shut down because of the state police felt that there were credible threats of potential militia violence.
Yeah, well, that's all pretty much spot on. I think, though, that they would resist the idea that they called upon militia groups to help them. Certainly they received offers, but when I've contacted them and talked to them, their spokespersons, they've said they're not accepting any help from the militia groups. But be that as it may, they've used some extremely intemperate language. They have attracted the attention of people involved in Patriot Movement groups in Oregon. And yeah, I mean, really, they've denied the Democrats quorum. You know, the Democrats have sort of tried to call their bluff, but it hasn't worked. And it looks at this point like they've got a pretty good shot of not having to vote on, let alone pass, that climate legislation. And, you know, it's not even the first time they've done it this session. They've employed a similar tactic of quorum busting in relation to other bills concerning trying to limit the exemptions people can have from vaccinations. and another bill about gun control. So this is the first time they've absconded from the state. But, the Democrats have super majorities in both houses, and it doesn't seem to be helping them to pass these kind of key elements of legislation. So it is worrying in terms of the precedent that it sets. If you don't have the majority, you can just blow up the Senate, apparently, and you might just get your way.
Well, not that they don't have a majority. There's a supermajority against them, right? So this is really the tyranny of the minority, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. The Democrats do have a supermajority, so that enables them actually to do far more sweeping things even than they're attempting to do in terms of, you know, changing taxation and stuff like that. But, yeah, unfortunately for the Democrats, they're too senators short of making up a quorum themselves. So the Republicans have settled on this tactic of just making it impossible for the Senate to sit. You know, as you would probably know, that Oregon is overwhelmingly a blue state. It overwhelmingly votes for Democrats. The Republicans almost exclusively represent rural areas of the state, which are more conservative, but are certainly not a majority of the state's population. If you can't get this kind of climate legislation passed in Oregon, you know, it doesn't bode well for the rest of the country taking steps to address climate change. Now, this was a cap and trade bill, very similar to California's, which has recently passed. You know, on the range of responses to climate change, it's probably pretty mild. It's a market-based mechanism, you know, which envisages a slow phasing out of carbon-intensive industries. But the claim of the Republicans is that this will negatively affect the livelihoods of a lot of their constituents in rural areas who are involved in extractive industries, especially forestry. That may or may not be true. What certainly is true is that it affects the interests of the people who donate to a lot of Republicans, the people who kind of own and run those extractive industries. And, you know, Coke Industries is a donor in Oregon, as it is in many other states. And Georgia-Pacific, the Coke-owned Georgia-Pacific, is a big player in the timber industry here. So, yeah, it certainly does affect their donors' interests, and they're clearly prepared to take pretty drastic measures to the extent some people, I'm sure, would say of subverting democracy in order to kind of get their way.
And in terms of the promise to protect, it was one of the senators who, members of the Oregon 3%, as a militia group, had offered to protect Brian Bocquist.
Yeah.
So you said that you checked. Did you check with Bocquist? Is he on the lam in Idaho? That's apparently where the Republican senators are hiding out.
Yeah, I've had it confirmed, and I've seen, you know, other reporting from the Washington Post where they're actually tracked down. I haven't tried to track the senators down in Idaho, but yeah, that's apparently where they are. It was certainly confirmed to me that they were out of state. Yeah, and one of the senators said that initially he'd gone to Washington, but Jay Inslee, who's the governor and a presidential candidate, said that they weren't welcome there, so he took himself off to Idaho. So that's apparently where they are. Yes, people claiming to represent the Oregon 3%, which is a patriot movement group, said that they were prepared to sort of protect the senators with armed force. I'm not sure that that was particularly welcome, but it seems that that is where, you know, the chatter on Facebook and other social media platforms is where Oregon State Police determined that there was a significant threat to the state house and perhaps to police themselves. So that's why they shut down. That's why the Democrats chose not to sit on Saturday. They did sit again on Sunday. There was a protest both Saturday, and there were protests both Saturday and Sunday. I went along on Sunday, and to be honest, it was not the kind of crowd I saw at the Malheur occupation. It was not a militia-heavy crowd. It was really just kind of rank-and-file Republicans, I would say, more. And, you know, there weren't any people there in tactical gear or anything like that. So the militia threat didn't, you know, materialize. But, of course, state police took that seriously and were right to take it seriously. I'm not sure how energetically state police pursuing the senators who are out of state. I'm not sure what jurisdiction they would even have to do that in Idaho. They've been pretty tight-lipped. I've been trying to ask them what's going on. They've been pretty tight-lipped. But it seems that there's a lot of political theatre going on here, obviously. And, you know, I suspect that perhaps the police aren't too thrilled to be involved in it all. But yeah, I mean, the indications this afternoon, and this is a developing story, as you know, but the indications this afternoon are that the Democrats perhaps are the ones who are going to blink in this situation, which is not encouraging, as I said earlier, for the future of, you know, measures to address climate change in this country.
So there's a last-minute attempt underway to get something passed, but they're two senators short, aren't they, even though they have a supermajority of the Democrats? So I guess that's why...
They're two senators short of a quorum, right? Yeah.
So we are to take Governor Kate Brown's claim that it's pretty much dead. Do you think that's it? There's no... They're not going to pull anything out of the hat here at the last minute today.
Well, not unless the state police successfully apprehend the Senate, I don't think. Yeah.
I see.
But it's really sort of a deadlock. And the Oregon Republican Party are not the first to do these quorum busting tactics. And they very gleefully pointed out that the Democrats, including then Senator Brown, did something similar back in 2001 over a redistricting proposal. And people in other legislatures have done this before as well, done this quorum-busting tactic. I think the significance, though, this time is that, you know, it's over climate legislation in a context where we're being told by the United Nations, by scientists, that we've got very little time left to address this problem. If you can't pass this kind of pretty mild climate change legislation in a state like Oregon, there's probably not much hope of passing one in states where oil is a big factor in the state's politics, states like Texas. You know, it doesn't bode well for state-level initiatives on this issue elsewhere, particularly in red states. So, yeah, I think that's the takeaway here, really, that it remains really exceptionally difficult in the face of intransigent minorities to pass any legislation that kind of addresses this problem.
And to be fair, of course, as you mentioned, Democrats, lawmakers in Texas and in Wisconsin have used this tactic of going out of town. Mm. But you mentioned the Koch brothers, funding and being the owners of Georgia-Pacific, a big player in the state. They're also, of course, one of the leading. They have oil refineries, pipelines, etc. They're very much in the oil business, and they have been funding climate change denial. So this tactic would presumably appeal to them.
Oh, I think so. And I mean, you know, the Koch brothers, we talk about them a lot, but of course they're not alone. I think that there are a lot of people, powerful people in the extractive and resource sector who want to delay any kind of measure that might limit the use of carbon-based fuels for as long as they possibly can. You know, and I doubt that the Republicans... I've got no evidence that Republicans are actually getting their riding instructions from the Koch brothers or anything like that. But the priorities, they share priorities, you know, with the people who run these extractive industries. They share the desire to, you know, clearly share the desire to delay or altogether stop any kind of measures that zero in on carbon-based fuels and carbon consumption. So, yeah, that's where we're at, I think. It's really been an extraordinary week because, you know, they've shown the extent to which they're prepared to play hardball on this issue. But as I said, I mean, right, they've done the same thing earlier in the session with legislation about vaccinations, with legislation about gun laws. I mean, there are other issues that they're prepared to right, kind of go almost as far on. So yeah,
this will be the new normal. So I thank you, Jason Wilson, for filling us in on this example of how democracy is not supposed to function, right? And thanks again.
Yeah. No problem. Happy to talk.
And again, I've been speaking with Jason Wilson, who is a reporter for The Guardian based in Portland, Oregon. And his latest article at The Guardian is Oregon Senator Walkout, Patriot Groups Vow to Protect Republicans Who Fled State. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.